This is BBC Radio 3. It's 3 o'clock and time for Proms Chamber Music live from Cadogan Hall. It's presented by Christopher Cook.
A very warm welcome to this afternoon's Proms Saturday matinee and to a programme of contemporary music in which an angel wrestles with an Old Testament patriarch and movie montage lends its techniques to a piano concerto. Welcome to the 21st century here at Cadogan Hall. David Atherton is going to conduct the London Sinfonietta and the BBC Singers with a pair of soloists in the British premiere of Sir Harrison Birtwistle's Angel Fighter. And Nicholas Hodges is the soloist in the very first performance of a BBC commission, George Apagis's piano concerto Chant contre Chant. That translates as shot counter shot. But first, a work that edits together a Michelangelo sonnet and lines from Dante. Sir Peter Maxwell Davies's Il Rosso Martello, commissioned for the BBC Singers in 1997. The sonnet that Peter Maxwell Davies chose circles the question of artistic inspiration and the act of creation that follows it. Il Rosso Martello translates as the crude hammer that the sculptor takes to the block of marble. A short introduction sets lines from Dante's Paradiso in a kind of plain song style. But as the composer has said, this is not emotion recollected in tranquility, but as knotty and full of muscle as a Michelangelo sculpture wrestling with itself. And in the final six lines of the sonnet, the poet charts the terrible solitude that comes to him when divine inspiration has gone. Hushed voices implore the sculptor's great mentor, Leonardo da Vinci, to look down favorably on him from heaven. And we return to Dante, wondering at the mysteries of the heavens. Would you please welcome now David Atherton to conduct the BBC Singers in Maxwell Davies's Il Rosso Martello.
Thank you.
Il Rosso Martello by Sir Peter Maxwell Davis, performed by the BBC singers to whom it's dedicated, and they were conducted by David Atherton. The soloists were Elizabeth Poole, Cherith Milburn Fryer, Edward Goethe, and Charles Gibbs. Next, a world premiere, which reminds us that this year the Proms are celebrating over a century of French music. Strictly speaking, Georges Apagis is Greek, not French. But although he was born in Athens after studying with Yannis Xenakis, he's lived and worked in Paris since 1963. And it was in France that he founded his music theatre workshop, Atelier Théâtre et Musique. Working with musicians and actors, Apagis transforms the everyday into a kind of poetry, in works that acknowledge a particularly French debt to surrealism and the absurd. The cinema has always teased us with the absurd, and it was Orson Welles, the great director, who called the cinema a ribbon of dreams that, like surrealism, brings us messages from another world that's not exactly our own. So why should we be surprised that Georges Apagis has chosen a technical term from the cutting room for his piano concerto? Chant contre chant is shot, reverse shot, or the way in which the cinema creates the illusion of two people talking to each other on screen. Although each of our characters is filmed individually, when they're edited together, we unconsciously assume that they are talking and looking at each other. Like those two characters, Georges Apagis' piano concerto shows, or rather lets us hear, two points of view. There's the pianist's point of view and that of the musicians. Sometimes the soloist creates the sound space in which the ensemble can fuse, Apagis says, and sometimes the ensemble creates the sound space that takes in the soloist. It is, it seems, a game of passive and active resistance between two parts. One of Apagesi's most admired works is the Hamlet Machina Oratorio, using the celebrated text by Heine Müller as the basis for a music drama. Written in 2000, the Hamlet Machine, as it's translated into English, is of course a piece that explores in ways that must have seemed very embarrassing to the East German regime, where Heine Müller was working with the Berliner Ensemble as Bertolt Brecht's heir, the consequences and the implications of totalitarianism, particularly in the Eastern Bloc and in China and in other places too. And there's a sense in which music theatre has been very much part of Georges Apagesi's career since the early 1960s. And now we're joined back by members of the London Sinfonietta who are going to tune for the piano concerto this afternoon. The soloist in this world premiere this afternoon is Nicholas Hodges, and David Atherton conducts the London Sinfonietta in Georges Apagesi's piano concerto, Chant contre Chant. Thank you.
Thank you.
As the Guardian newspaper reported recently, Nicholas Hodges' recitals always boldly go where few other pianists dare. And Georges Apagis's chant, contre-chant, seems magnificently to have led him even further astray. David Atherton conducted members of the London Sinfonietta. Sir Harrison Birtwistle's music has always carefully and deliberately gone where no other composers have dared, and particularly in the manner in which he has treated myth and traditional stories, from Punch and Judy to the Minotaur. The story of Jacob wrestling with the angel is not exactly myth or folktale, but this is not the first time that Birtwistle has set material from the Christian Bible. There was The Last Supper, first performed in Berlin and at Glyndebourne 11 years ago. Angel Fighter is the story of Jacob wrestling with the angel of God from the book of Genesis, as retold by the librettist Stephen Place. It's composed for a pair of soloists, a choir, and a modestly sized instrumental ensemble. It was a commission from last year's Leipzig Barkfest, a festival which tries to explore contemporary responses to the 18th century master, as well as playing his own music. Harrison Birtwistle has always had a deep engagement with Bach's music, so the commission to write what is perhaps a cantata had an impeccable logic. Well, I'm joined now for this Saturday Proms matinee here at Cadogan Hall by Sir Harrison Birtwistle. Can I ask you first, what made you choose this story of Jacob wrestling with the angel from the book of Genesis?
There's a picture, and it's been in my head for a long time, and it seemed to include the ingredients of something dramatic all at once, whereas in music you have to spread the narrative across time. So I gave Stephen the task of doing that and making it into a sort of drama. Well, yeah.
We were talking earlier about the way in which, if you're growing up in this country in particular traditions, hymns stay in your mind, and so does the Bible. And I wonder if the picture that you had in your mind is something that's been there really since you were a small child, a young man as well.
Yes, I can't remember where it came in. It's maybe some sort of storybook sometime, because it certainly has the ingredients of a child's story and a very simple narrative, which in a sense, when you do something in terms of music, you need a foreground which is simple, and with that you can proliferate the foreground into something maybe a little more complex.
It's perhaps also a struggle for self-understanding, for self-knowledge. Is that something too that appealed to you about this particular story, in a way, the way in which Jacob becomes Israel?
I don't know. I'm sorry. Yeah, that's a difficult one.
But you are interested.
A simple attraction to something, like which I've sort of done for quite a long time in my life. And I don't begin with words. I become to express something dramatic. I begin with something very simple, which in this sense is visual. When I wrote The Last Supper, the idea of 12 men sitting round a table was what. Yeah. And in the case of Gawain, how do you make a noble pantomime horse? You know, which is something. You know, and so on. And in the Minotaur, how do you express that in terms of a human being? And I gave Stephen, we wrote a piece called The Eo Passion, in which we just simply set up a room, the inside of a room and the outside of the room. And I said to Stephen, I want a woman on the inside and a man on the outside, and I want him to send her a letter. And what do you want him to say? I don't care what you say, what he says, because that's where drama begins. So he gave something which is, in a sense, a fait accompli, and we went from there.
I'm sure you'll tease me again, but you mentioned Minotaur, you mentioned Gawain, and The Last Supper. All of these three pieces and so much of your work for the theatre, the dramatic work, it always has at its heart this turning point, a point where something happens that is fundamental to the people involved. It's the same here, surely, with the Jacob wrestling with the angel.
Yes, something absolutely fundamental. Where and he's been in what's interesting about this, he's been told to wait somewhere. That already is quite an interesting dramatic concept. And of course, the chorus, the function of the chorus, where he's leading them out and leading them along, don't understand this. Then there becomes a sort of drama between the two. But he says, I'm staying here and waiting for something. He's been told to wait. I can't remember who told him, but he was told to wait. And in fact, then the angel comes.
When the commission came from the Leipzig Festival, was there any kind of restrictions on what resources you were able to write for, or did you simply choose the ensemble and choose the two soloists and the chorus?
Well, it's given, isn't it? There's an angel and there's Jacob, and then there has to be a chorus, so that is sort of set up. I began by thinking, how do you write something very formal and Bachian, and but I got too sort of interested in the dramatic nature of it, so it becomes a sort of more overtly dramatic. Yeah.
But we can hear Bach in it, and we can hear perhaps also Bach's own sense of drama that revealed in his own cantatas.
Yes, but not. I hope it's there, but it was never consciously put there. I mean, but Bach is one of my passions, and. But if you ask me what it is, I would be hard pushed.
Was it a special moment to have the first performance of this piece in the Thomaskirche in Leipzig, in Bach's own church?
That was just fortuitive. But the chorus did actually sing their part on the grave of Bach. He's actually there in the middle of the nave, of the choir, yeah.
Sir Harrison Birbislaw, thank you very much indeed for being with us this afternoon.
My pleasure.
That applause both for Sir Harrison Birtwistle here at Cadogan Hall and for members of the London Sinfonietta and the BBC Singers who are returning to the platform here and who in a moment will tune. The London Sinfonietta, who are playing for these Cadogan Prom Saturday matinees, are perhaps one of course the leading contemporary music ensembles in the United Kingdom and indeed further afield, and they have an absolute commitment to new music, indeed the kind of new music that we're hearing this afternoon. They've commissioned work from Harrison Birtwistle, Berio, Steve Reich, and a younger generation of contemporary British composers too, Tamsin Davis, Dai Fujikura, for example. And now we're going to hear members of the London Sinfonietta tuning before our last piece this afternoon. Will you please now welcome the tenor, Geoffrey Lloyd Roberts, as Jacob, the countertenor, Andrew Watts, singing the role of the angel in this first British performance of Angel Fighter. The BBC Singers and members of the London Sinfonietta are conducted by David Atherton.
Thank you. Tell me your name.
Thy name shall be called no more Jacob, but Israel, for as a prince hast thou power with God and with men. Jacob has wrestled the angel of God into blessing him. The turning point in Harrison Birtwistle's retelling of Jacob wrestling with the angel. Geoffrey Lloyd Roberts sang the role of Jacob in Angel Fighter, and Andrew Watts was the angel. The BBC singers, chorus master Matthew Hamilton, and the members of the London Sinfonietta, led this afternoon by Daniel Rowland, were conducted by David Atherton. And that's an end to Wrestling with Angels for this afternoon. In next week's Saturday matinee, we'll be counting them standing on the head of a pin when the BBC singers are joined by Symphony for a prom that pays tribute to the music of Hildegard of Bingen, with her own music and with another world premiere of a BBC commission, Out of This World, Stevie Wishart setting of four of Hildegard's own poems. There's also music by Benjamin Britten and Harrison Birtwistle again, with both composers setting visionary medieval texts. I do hope that you'll all join me in a week's time. But now here's David Cornett with the rest of BBC Radio 3 this afternoon.
And our concert was presented by Christopher Cook.
From the BBC Proms on Radio 3 comes a bicentenary celebration of a master pianist. Franz Liszt's piano music is brought to life in a late-night proms recital from Marc-André Amelin. Just over an hour of bewitching virtuosity and a programme that traverses the entire range of Liszt's entrancing musical world. Wednesday night, 10 o'clock, BBC Radio 3.
Well, coming up next this afternoon here on BBC Radio 3's Jazz Library. That's about 6 minutes away. We have time for a couple, or maybe more, of Promenade by Francis Poulenc, played by Eric Parkin. This first one takes place in flight, en avion.
Thank you.
Well, I have to say that didn't sound much to me like being in flight, but there you are. This one's called En Voiture, by car. This can hardly be faster, but let's give it a whirl. A complete mystery to me, I must say. Thank goodness we have no time to hear going by bicycle or by boat or even on foot, because that would have been even slower. Eric Parkin playing a couple, or was it three, of Poulenc's Promenade. BBC Radio 3, it's 4:30. Time now for Jazz Library, and here's Alan Shipton.
Today, Jazz Library focuses on a musician who started his career as a saxophonist but became one of the most successful and wide-ranging composers and arrangers in jazz, Oliver Nelson. This is Oliver Nelson's version of What's New from the album Meet Oliver Nelson, which came out in 1959 from Prestige and now reissued on Original Jazz Classics. And to talk about Oliver Nelson's music and select some of his finest recordings, I'm joined by Guy Barker. And Guy, listening to him there, you can imagine that this is a man who had a great career ahead of him just as a saxophonist.
Absolutely. But listening to it, the lines that he plays on the saxophone, there's a very definite sound to it. It's like every note is meant. And I know it's tricky to discuss that now because we know what happened in his life and we knew that he went on to that. But as he entered the second eight of that, there's a line and a way he played his improvisation that sound almost like it could be a line he would have written for instruments in an orchestra as well.
I'm sure you're right that that compositional brain was going right from day one.
You can hear that arranger's mind working.
Now, very early on in his career, he was picked up by Prestige as a soloist. And in one of the early sessions that they made with him in 1960, he was teamed up with the unlikely partners of King Curtis, who'd come out of the rhythm and blues world on tenor saxophone, and also Jimmy Forrest, who'd been with the Count Basie Orchestra, to go back to it. It's an interesting thing because this is a very, very gentle tenor battle. And I think we agree that it starts with Oliver Nelson, is followed by the much bluesier sound of King Curtis, and then rounded off with the very consummate bebop lines of Jimmy Forrest. It's interesting that, again, at this point, he's jousting with other players, albeit fairly gently, and that looks like the direction his career is going to take.
It does, but also, as you can tell from the title of the piece, which is Soul Street, we're just about to get into the 60s and his star is rising as an arranger, and the sound that always was in his writing that followed definitely had its roots in blues and very soulful type of music. So you can hear it all here in this playing.
Thank you. Soul Street by Oliver Nelson, King Curtis and Jimmy Forrest, recorded in September 1960. That's on the Prestige Record Story, a 4-CD set that tells the early story of the emergence of that independent record label, or at least it was independent back then. And it came out first on an album called Soul Battle, which is still just about available. We're going to move on to 1961 and the beginning of a partnership that was really very important for Oliver Nelson, which was with the producer Creed Taylor. And Creed was working at this point for Impulse, which is a relatively new record label. And Oliver Nelson managed to make one of the albums which is a completely iconic early 1960s record, which is called Blues in the Abstract Truth. And on it, a tune which is probably the best known of all the compositions he produced, Stolen Moments. It was a remarkable moment, Guy, wasn't it? Because suddenly this is a man who's been a player announcing that he's much more than that.
This album was made in 1961. It's only 2 years after Kind of Blue, and it's got that sort of feeling there, except, of course, the moment that Freddie Hubbard comes beautifully in, just pouring out all that fantastic music. And it's a great moment because it has such a distinct sound to it and a style. And Oliver Nelson was suddenly there. So it's 50 years ago this was made. And I think this was the beginning of Impulse Records. I think they actually formed in 1960, but they only made one album. I think it was a J.J. Johnson, Kai Winding album. And then we got to 1961 and it all kicked off and Bob Thiel joined. And so you had these two amazing producers, this incredible array of musicians. And from that moment, 1961, that label just took off. And I think that this was the thing that launched it.
One of the things we're going to hear in the track is the very interesting voicing of Freddie Hubbard's trumpet, Eric Dolphy on alto sax here, and George Barrow on baritone. There's a very close harmony. And rather like Ellington, the notes don't always go to the instrument you're expecting them to go to.
No, that's true. But that sound stays with him. The way he voices, where you have the lead line and the bass line, but right in the centre, the instruments in the middle of the voicing are very, very close together. And that kind of sound that gives it that edge stayed with him all the way through.
Thank you.
just part of Stolen Moments from Blues and the Abstract Truth on Impulse, recorded in February 1961 with Freddie Hubbard, Eric Dolphy, George Barrow, Bill Evans on piano, Paul Chambers bass and Roy Haynes drums. And that's out from Impulse. We're going to move on to, in a way, a development directly from that guy. You said that Oliver Nelson's voicings were something that stayed with him all his life. And in the beginning of a piece that he recorded many times in his career called Hobo Flats, which he did with his big band on the album Fantabulous, you hear that voicing working, first of all in the brass section, then he adds the reeds as a counterpoint to the trombones. So right the way through the first chorus of this piece, we've got that very knotted together, tight writing for most of the horns with the opposition of the trombones playing something a bit different. And it's going to be something we'll hear again and again as the programme progresses, but he certainly continues to develop the idea.
Oh, completely. And the thing that I love about this particular album, Fantabulous, is, well, as you'll hear on Hobo Flats, all the things you were just talking about, the way he develops the first couple of choruses where you've got the rhythm section playing, you have the trombones doing something, then you have the two trumpets playing a hint of the theme, and then the whole band comes in just to launch into the piano solo by Patty Brown, played on a terribly out-of-tune upright piano. It's quite amazing. There's all this amazing stuff going on, and then there's this Chad Valley piano comes in, played very well, of course. And then when you get to the main chorus, it's, again, one of Oliver Nelson's gifts, because even in those days, when there was so much music going on, so many jazz orchestras playing, I'm sure some of these lineups were created through budget restraints, because the lineup is actually two trumpets here, two trombones and four reeds. Relatively small, but it sounds much bigger. It sounds like there's eight brass there. And his gift of writing and composition and orchestration and how he can get all those different sounds he hears in his head. We'll be right back.
That's Hobo Flats, played by the Oliver Nelson Big Band from the album Fantabulous on the Verve label, recorded in March 1964. And the full personnel of that can be found on the Jazz Library website, which is bbc.co.uk/radio3/jazzlibrary. It wasn't long after that, in 1964, Guy, that Oliver Nelson started really freelancing for a huge range of different musicians, writing for their big bands, writing for, in some cases, their small groups, or simply directing sessions in the studio. We're going to move to a Blue Note album by Stanley Turrentine, who was a very strong bastion of that label at the time, and a wonderful big band that was arranged for him by Oliver. And immediately it's got some hallmarks, not least the Latinish percussion going on with something that's actually a pretty straight-ahead bluesy number.
Yeah, and it features the amazing Stanley Turrentine, who has just such an individual sound. And he gives him the opportunity to just sort of float over the top of this amazing orchestra. And the thing that I personally love about this so much, and it kind of sums up so much of what Oliver Nelson is all about, is that, you know, you hear so many people, when a certain sound is attributed to an era, there's lots of people that can talk about the 40s, the 50s and 60s. But for my money, the sound of the 60s is Oliver Nelson. And examples like this, which just has one of those sort of grooves that I can never, ever tire of. It's just glorious. And you've got people like Bob Cranshaw and Kenny Burrell and Herbie Hancock in the rhythm section, just masters of their craft, saying, right, we're just going to get in here and play a 60s boogaloo type of groove. I think they call it boogaloo now.
The other interesting thing about that, and you can certainly hear the rhythm section doing that, is that the big band doesn't drop out for much of this. There are plenty of examples later in his career where Oliver Nelson would top and tail a performance by soloists. But here, they're riffing behind him, the band comes back. And so this Percy Mayfield tune, River's Invitation, has something of the feel of a soul arrangement running all the way through it. And in particular, the sense that you never quite lose contact with the horn section and the reeds who are sitting there backing up Stanley.
Yes, and I'm certain that because of this kind of thing, this is what must have attracted the ears of all of those TV and film producers that ended up using him later on as their main composer. Thank you.
Anthony Tarantine and River's Invitation on Blue Note, and that comes from Stanley's album Joyride, recorded in April 1965 and still available from that label. It's also included on the Best of Stanley Tarantine from Blue Note as well. The band included Bob Cranshaw on bass, Kenny Burrell on guitar, Herbie Hancock piano, Grady Tate on drums, with the full Oliver Nelson Orchestra, and notable in the sections there, Clark Terry on the trumpet, J.J. Johnson trombone, Phil Woods and Jerry Dodgen amongst the reeds. And Jerry Dodgen was one of those remarkably versatile musicians, Guy, still is, who was used a lot by big bands at that stage. But I think Oliver Nelson particularly loved his flute playing. And the next piece we're going to hear, which is called 13 brackets Death March from the Jimmy Smith Wes Montgomery album, The Dynamic Duo, really makes a great play of Jerry Dodgen's flute in the opening chorus.
Well, he does. But also in the section, there are other people like Jerome Richardson and Bob Ashton and Phil Woods and Danny Bank and all those people who at that time were doing lots of studio work just as much as they were probably going out and playing jazz. But in this opportunity, you know, playing with Jimmy Smith and Wes Montgomery and Oliver Nelson probably gave them a lot more of a creative moment. But they all had to double. They learnt all those instruments and they were all very good on clarinet and flutes and alto flutes. And particularly here, apart from Jerry Dodgen, there's also a number of others here who are playing alto flutes. And again, that's another one of those sounds, isn't it? A lot of people attribute that to Henry Mancini using three alto flutes and a couple of bass flutes and stuff like that. But it was definitely a very hip sound at the time. Team
Death March from the album The Dynamic Duo by Jimmy Smith and Wes Montgomery, recorded in September 1966 with arrangements and an orchestra directed by the subject of today's Jazz Library, Oliver Nelson. This is Jazz Library on BBC Radio 3 with me, Alan Shipton, and my guest, Guy Barker. And we'll be following through the career of Oliver Nelson as both instrumentalist and arranger to the end of his rather short career. And he was already, by 1966, beginning to find a third end of the candle to burn.
Yes, I mean, I've heard stories from friends of mine that knew him, people like Roger Kellaway and Billy Cobham, and they often have told me that probably that's what led to the end of his short life, because he just became the first call guy for so many things, whether it was doing the albums that you've heard already, but also I think he wrote the music for over 40 of the episodes of Ironside. He wrote the music for The Bionic Woman. He wrote arrangements for Diana Ross and once for Ringo Starr. So many things. And they said that the vocalist would come in, like Nancy Wilson, who he worked with a lot, and they'd say that they would have a piano rehearsal on one day and work out the songs, and then he had to go off and just write all those arrangements to be ready in the studio with only a few days to go. And with everything coming in like that, I guess it was difficult to turn anything down. And they say that he just kept going all the way through the night.
You're talking about people just calling him for stuff. And in 1966, Buddy Rich, who'd been working, I think, for a long time with Harry James, decided to launch his own big band and went to Hollywood to do so, signed up by Dick Bock for the Pacific Jazz label, and here's a new big band with a tremendous drummer, short of arrangements. So who do they call?
Oliver Nelson.
The album Swingin' New Big Band is the first of that little group of Pacific Jazz albums that came out from the mid-60s. And here again, you've got a mixture of what we've heard so far, the very distinctive voicings, this slightly bluesy feel in the rhythm, Buddy Rich absolutely latching onto the way that the arrangements work with kind of strong backbeat feel. It's a very compact package, and yet this is very typical of the kind of chart that he was producing for lots and lots of different bands.
Well, yeah, and the thing that's great about them is it's so well written that you could imagine the first run-through, when they first saw this chart, it would have felt comfortable. Musicians would often say the words, "It plays itself."
Thank you. Soul, the Buddy Rich Big Band, from the album Swinging New Big Band, recorded in October 1966 on the West Coast, and the full personnel on the website, the address to come one more time before the end of the programme. You were saying that Oliver Nelson started being first call arranger for all sorts of different people, and just a year after that, in 1967, he made the first of two albums with the singer Nancy Wilson. And it's clear by this time he'd been working with Hollywood forces, and he completely understood how to write for a string orchestra and integrate that with a jazz group. The jazz rhythm section in this first album, Lush Life, is a pretty remarkable one, with the guitarist John Collins standing out, Buster Williams on bass, Shelly Mann on drums, and Victor Feldman on vibes. They give it a very special character, but the way in which he weaves the orchestra in and out of that and backs Nancy is simply superb.
This is one of the most glorious albums ever made, I would say. This is the album that I can honestly say I've heard more times than I've heard any other album. I first heard it on a cassette in the early 80s. I was living in Covent Garden and somebody came back to my flat after a gig and played this to me, and all it had on it was Nancy Wilson. And they left the cassette there and I would listen to this over and over again, and I searched high and low, and eventually I found the LP. And it was one of those albums where I thought I was just listening to it, because I always used to listen to albums because I wanted to be educated. I wanted to learn more. I wanted to find how this music worked. And I always thought that this album was just one I could sit back and just go to another place with. But in actual fact, it was the album that inspired me to want to write for orchestras. And in